Bastian went to the gate, but before opening it, he glanced back. Rogroman had sat down on the black rock. He was as black as the stone. In a faint, far-off voice, he said, "Quite possibly, Master, you will hear sounds that will frighten you. Don't be afraid. As long as you carry the emblem, nothing can happen to you." Bastian nodded and passed through the gate. The room he entered was magnificent. The floor was laid with soft, richly colored carpets. The graceful columns supporting the vaulted ceiling were covered with gold mosaic, which fragmented the vari-colored light of the lamps. In one corner, Bastian saw a broad divan, covered with soft rugs and cushions of all kinds, surmounted by a canopy of azure-blue silk. In the opposite corner, the stone floor had been hollowed to form a pool filled with golden liquid. On a low table stood bowls and dishes of food, a carafe full of some ruby-red drink, and a golden cup. Bastian squatted down at the table and fell to. The drink had a tart, wild taste and was wonderfully thirst-quenching. The dishes were unknown to Bastian. Some looked like cakes or nuts, others like squash or melons. But the taste was entirely different, sharp and spicy. Everything was delicious, and Bastian ate his fill. Then he took his clothes off, but not the amulet, and stepped into the pool. For a while he splashed about, washed himself, dived under, and came up puffing like a walrus. Then he discovered some strange-looking bottles at the edge of the pool. Thinking they must be bath oils, he poured a little of each into the water. Green, red, and yellow flames darted hissing over the surface, and a little smoke went up. It smelled of resin and bitter herbs. And then the flames died. After a while, Bastian got out of the water, dried himself with the soft towels that lay ready, and put his clothes on. Suddenly he noticed that the lamps were not burning as brightly as before, and then he heard a sound that sent the cold shivers down his spine, a cracking and grinding as though a rock were bursting under the pressure of expanding ice. Bastian's heart pounded. He remembered that Grogramon had told him not to be afraid. The sound softened to a moan and soon stopped. It was not repeated, but the stillness was almost more terrible. Determined to find out what had happened, Bastian opened the door of the bedchamber. At first he saw no change in the great hall, except that the lamplight now seemed somber and was pulsating like a faltering heartbeat. The lion was still sitting in the same attitude on the black rock. He seemed to be looking at Bastian. "Grogramon!" Bastian cried. "What's going on? What was that sound? Was it you?" The lion made no answer and didn't move. But when Bastian approached him, the lion followed him with his eyes. Hesitantly, Bastian stretched out his hand to stroke the lion's mane. But the moment he touched it, he recoiled in horror. It was hard and ice-cold, like the black rock. And Grogramon's face and paws felt the same way. Bastian didn't know what to do. He saw that the black stone doors were slowly opening. He left the hall, but it wasn't until he had passed through the long, dark corridor and was on his way up the stairs that he started wondering what he would do when he was outside. In this desert, there couldn't be anyone capable of saving Grogramon. But it wasn't a desert anymore. Whichever way Bastian looked, he saw glittering dots. Millions of tiny plants were sprouting from the grains of sand, which had become seeds again. Perilin, the night forest, was growing once more. Bastian sensed that Grogramon's rigidity was somehow connected with this transformation. He went back to the cave. The light in the lamps was barely flickering. He went over to the lion, threw his arms around the huge neck, and pressed his face to the beast's face. The lion's eyes were black and as dead as the rock. Grogramon had turned to stone. The lights flared for an instant and went out, leaving the cave in total darkness. Bastian wept bitterly. The stone lion was wet with his tears. In the end, the boy curled up between the great paws and fell asleep. 15. Grogramon, the many-colored death.
Oh, master, said the rumbling lion's voice, have you spent the whole night like this?
Bastian sat up and rubbed his eyes. He had been lying between the lion's paws, and Grogramon was watching him with a look of amazement. His fur was still as black as the rock he was sitting on, but his eyes sparkled. The lamps in the cave were burning again. Oh, Bastian cried, I thought you had turned to stone.
So I had, the lion replied. I die with every nightfall, and every morning I wake up again.
I thought it was forever, said Bastian.
It always is forever, said Grogramon mysteriously.
He stood up, stretched, and trotted about the cave. His fur shone more and more brightly in the colors of the mosaic floor. Suddenly he stopped still and looked at the boy.
Did you shed tears over me? He asked.
Bastian nodded.
Then, said the lion, you are not only the only being who has ever slept between the paws of the many-colored death, but also the only being who has ever mourned his death.
Bastian looked at the lion, who was trotting about again, and finally asked him in a whisper, Are you always alone? Again the lion stood still, but this time he did not turn toward Bastian. He kept his face averted and repeated in his rumbling voice,
Alone.
The word echoed through the cave.
My realm is the desert, and it is also my work. Wherever I go, everything around me turns to desert. I carry it with me. Since I am made of deadly fire, must I not be doomed to everlasting solitude?
Bastian fell into a dismayed silence.
Master, said the lion, looking at the boy with glowing eyes, you who bear the emblem of the childlike empress, can you tell me this? Why must I always die at nightfall?
So that peril in the night forest can grow in the desert of colors, said Bastian.
Perilin, said the lion. What's that?
Then Bastian told him about the miraculous jungle that consisted of living light. While Grogramon listened in fascinated amazement, Bastian described the diversity and beauty of the glimmering phosphorescent plants, their silent, irresistible growth, their dreamlike beauty, and incredible size. His enthusiasm grew as he spoke, and Grogramon's eyes glowed more and more brightly. All that, Bastian concluded, can happen only when you are turned to stone. But Perilin would swallow up everything else and stifle itself if it didn't have to die and crumble into dust when you wake up. You and Perilin need each other. For a long while, Grogramon was silent.
Master, he said then. Now I see that my dying gives life, and my living death, and both are good. Now I understand the meaning of my existence. I thank you.
He strode slowly and solemnly into the darkest corner of the cave. Bastian couldn't see what he did there, but he heard a jangling of metal. When Grogramon came back, he was carrying something in his mouth. With a deep bow, he laid this something at Bastian's feet. It was a sword. It didn't look very impressive. The iron sheath was rusty, and the hilt might have belonged to a child's wooden sword.
Can you give it a name?
Grogramon asked. Bastian examined it carefully. Sikanda, he said.
In that same moment, the sword darted from its sheath and flew into his hand. The blade consisted of pure light and glittered so brightly that he could hardly bear to look at it.
It was double-edged and weighed no more than a feather.
This sword has been destined for you since the beginning of time, said Grogramon. For only one who has ridden on my back, who has eaten and drunk of my fire and bathed in it like you, can touch it without danger. But only because you have given it its right name does it belong to you.
Sikanda, said Bastian under his breath, as, fascinated by the gleaming light, he swung the sword slowly through the air. It's a magic sword, isn't it?
Nothing in all Fantastica can resist it, said Grogramon, neither rock nor steel. But you must not use force. Whatever may threaten you, you may wield it only if it leaps into your hand of its own accord, as it did now. It will guide your hand, and by its own power will do what needs to be done. But if your will makes you draw it from its sheath, you will bring misfortune on yourself, and on Fantastica. Never forget that.
I will never forget it, Bastian promised. The sword flew back into its sheath, and again it looked old and worthless. Bastian grasped the leather belt on which the sheath hung, and slung it around his waist.
And now, master, Grogramon suggested, let us, if you wish, go racing through the desert together. Climb on my back, for I must go out now.
Bastian mounted, and the lion trotted out into the open. The night forest had long since crumbled into colored sand, and the morning sun rose above the desert horizon. Together, they swept over the dunes like a dancing flame, like a blazing tempest. Bastian felt as though he were riding a flaming comet through light and colors. Toward midday, Grogramon stopped.
This, master, is the place where we met.
Bastian's head was still reeling from the wild ride. He looked around, but could see neither the ultramarine blue nor the fiery red hill. Nor was there any sign of the letters he had made. Now the dunes were olive green and pink. It's all entirely different, he said.
Yes, master, said the lion. That's the way it is, different every day. Up until now I didn't know why. But since you told me that Perilin grows out of the sand, I understand.
But how do you know it's the same place as yesterday?
I feel it as I feel my own body. The desert is a part of me.
Bastian climbed down from Grogramon's back and seated himself on the olive-green hill. The lion lay beside him, and now he too was olive-green. Bastian propped his chin on his hand and looked out toward the horizon. Grogramon, he said after a long silence, may I ask you a question?
Your servant is listening.
Is it true that you've always been here?
Always.
And the desert of Goab has always existed?
Yes, the desert too. Why do you ask?
Bastian pondered. I don't get it, he finally confessed. I'd have bet it wasn't here before yesterday morning.
What makes you think that, master?
Then Bastian told him everything that had happened since he met Moonchild. It's all so strange, he concluded. A wish comes into my head, and then something always happens that makes the wish come true. I haven't made this up, you know. I wouldn't be able to. I could never have invented all the different night plants in Perilin, or the colors of the Goab, or you. It's all much more wonderful and real than anything I could have made up. But all the same, nothing is here until I've wished it.
That, said the lion, is because you're carrying Orin, the gem.
But does all this exist only after I've wished it? Or was it all there before?
Both, said Grogramon.
How can that be? Bastian cried, almost impatiently. You've been here in Goab, the Desert of Colors, since heaven knows when. The room at your palace was waiting for me since the beginning of time. So too was the sword Sikandar. You told me so yourself.
That is true, Master.
But I've only been in Phantastica since last night. So it can't be true that all these things have existed only since I came here.
Master, the lion replied calmly, didn't you know that Phantastica is the land of stories? A story can be new, and yet tell about olden times. The past comes into existence with the story.
Then Perilin too must always have been there, said the perplexed Bastian.
Beginning at the moment when you gave it its name, Grogramon replied, it has existed forever.
You mean that I created it?
The lion was silent for a while. Then he said, only the childlike empress can tell you that. It is she who has given you everything.
He arose.
Master, it's time we went back to my palace. The sun is low in the sky, and we have a long way to go. That night, Grogramon lay down again on the black rock, and this time Bastian stayed with him. Few words passed between them. Bastian brought food and drink from the bedchamber, where once again the little table had been laid by an unseen hand. He seated himself on the steps leading to the lion's rock, and there he ate his supper. When the light of the lamps grew dim and began to pulsate like a faltering heartbeat, he stood up and threw his arms around the lion's neck. The mane was hard and looked like congealed lava. Then the gruesome sound was repeated. Bastian was no longer afraid, but again he wept at the thought of Grogramon's sufferings, for now he knew they would endure for all time. Later that night, Bastian groped his way into the open and stood for a long while watching the soundless growth of the night plants. Then he went back into the cave and again lay down to sleep between the petrified lion's paws. He stayed with Grogramon for many days and nights, and they became friends. They spent many hours in the desert, playing wild games. Bastian would hide among the sand dunes, but Grogramon always found him. They ran races, but the lion was 1,000 times swifter than Bastian. They wrestled, and here Bastian was the lion's equal. Though of course it was only in fun, Grogramon needed all his strength to hold his own. Neither could defeat the other. Once, after they'd been wrestling and tumbling, Bastian sat down, somewhat out of breath, and said, couldn't I stay with you forever? The lion shook his mane. No, Master.
Why not?
Here there is only life and death, only Perilin and Goab, but no story. You must live your story. You cannot remain here.
But how can I leave? Bastian asked. The desert is much too big. I'd never get to the end of it. And you can't carry me out of it, because you take the desert with you.
Only your wishes can guide you over the pathways of Phantastica, said Grogramon. You must go from wish to wish. What you don't wish for will always be beyond your reach. That is what the words far and near mean in Phantastica. And wishing to leave a place is not enough. You must wish to go somewhere else, and let your wishes guide you.
But I can't wish to leave here, said Bastian.
You must find your next wish, said Grogramon, almost sternly.
And when I find it, Bastian asked, how will I be able to leave here?
I will tell you, said Grogramon gravely. There is in Phantastica a certain place from which no one can go anywhere, and which can be reached from anywhere. We call it the Temple of 1,000 Doors.
No one has ever seen it from outside. The inside is a maze of doors. Anyone wishing to know it must dare to enter it.
But how is that possible if it can't be approached from outside?
Every door in Fantastica, said the lion, even the most ordinary stable, kitchen or cupboard door, can become the entrance to the Temple of 1,000 doors at the right moment. And none of these 1,000 doors leads back to where one came from. There is no return.
And once someone is inside, Bastian asked, can he get out and go somewhere?
Yes, said the lion, but it's not as simple as in other buildings. Only a genuine wish can lead you through the maze of 1,000 doors. Without a genuine wish, you just have to wander around until you know what you really want. And that can take a long time.
How will I find the entrance?
You've got to wish it.
Bastian pondered a long while. Then he said, It seems strange that we can't just wish what we please. Where do our wishes come from? What is a wish, anyway?
Grogramon gave the boy a long, earnest look, but made no answer. Some days later, they had another serious talk. Bastian had shown the lion the inscription on the reverse side of the gem.
What do you suppose it means? He asked. Do what you wish. That must mean I can do anything I feel like, don't you think so?
All at once, Grogramon's face looked alarmingly grave, and his eyes glowed. No, he said in his deep, rumbling voice. It means that you must do what you really and truly want, and nothing is more difficult.
What I really and truly want? What do you mean by that?
It's your own deepest secret, and you yourself don't know it.
How can I find out?
By going the way of your wishes, from one to another, from first to last. It will take you to what you really and truly want.
That doesn't sound so hard, said Bastian.
It is the most dangerous of all journeys.
Why? Bastian asked. I'm not afraid.
That isn't it, Grogramon rumbled. It requires the greatest honesty and vigilance, because there's no other journey on which it's so easy to lose yourself forever.
Do you mean because our wishes aren't always good? Bastian asked.
The lion lashed the sand he was lying on with his tail. His ears lay flat, he screwed up his nose, and his eyes flashed fire. Involuntarily, Bastian ducked when Grogramon's voice once again made the earth tremble. What do you know about wishes? How would you know what's good and what isn't?
In the days that followed, Bastian thought a good deal about what the many-colored death had said. There are some things, however, that we cannot fathom by thinking about them, but only by experience. So it was not until much later, after all manner of adventures, that he thought back on Grogramon's words and began to understand them. At this time, another change took place in Bastian. Since his meeting with Moonchild, he had received many gifts. Now he was favored with a new one, courage. And again, something was taken away from him, namely the memory of his past timidity. Since he was no longer afraid of anything, a new wish began, imperceptibly at first, then more distinctly, to take shape within him. The wish to be alone no longer. Even in the company of the many-colored death, he was alone in a way. He wanted to exhibit his talents to others, to be admired, and to become famous. And one night, as he was watching Perilin grow, it suddenly came to him that he was doing so for the last time, that he would have to bid the grandiose night forest goodbye. An inner voice was calling him away. He cast a last glance at the magnificently glowing colors. Then he descended to the darkness of Grogramon's palace and tomb, and sat down on the steps. He couldn't have said what he was waiting for, but he knew he could not sleep that night. He must have dozed a little, for suddenly he started, as if someone had called his name. The door leading to the bedchamber had opened. Through the cleft, a long strip of reddish light shone into the dark cave. Bastian stood up. Had the door been transformed for this moment into the entrance of the Temple of 1,000 Doors? Hesitantly, he approached the cleft and tried to peer through. He couldn't see a thing. Then, slowly, the cleft began to close. In a moment, his only chance would pass. He turned back to Grogramon, who lay motionless, with eyes of dead stone on his pedestal. The strip of light from the door fell full on him. "Goodbye, Grogramon, and thanks for everything," he said softly. "I'll come again, I promise. I'll come again." Then he slipped through the cleft, and instantly the door closed behind him. Bastian didn't know that he would not keep his promise. Much, much later, someone would come in his name and keep it for him. But that's another story, and shall be told another time. 16. The Silver City of Amarganth. Purple light passed in slow waves across the floor and the walls of the room. It was a hexagonal room, rather like the enlarged cell of a honeycomb. Every second wall had a door in it, and on the intervening walls were painted strange pictures representing landscapes and creatures who seemed to be half plant and half animal. Bastian had entered through one of the doors. The other two, to the right and left of it, were exactly the same shape, but the left-hand door was black, while the right-hand one was white. Bastian chose the white door. In the next room, the light was yellowish. Here again, the walls formed a hexagon. The pictures represented all manner of contrivances that meant nothing to Bastian. Were they tools or weapons? The two doors leading onward to the right and left were the same color, yellow. But the left-hand one was tall and narrow, while the one on the right was low and wide. Bastian chose the left-hand one. The next room was hexagonal like the others, but the light was bluish. The pictures on the walls were of intricate ornaments or characters in a strange alphabet. Here the two doors were the same color, but of different material, one of wood, the other of metal. Bastian chose the wooden door. It is not possible to describe all the doors and rooms through which Bastian passed during his stay in the Temple of 1,000 Doors. There were doors that looked like large keyholes, others that resembled the entrances to caves. There were golden doors and rusty iron doors. Some were padded, and some were studded with nails. Some were paper thin, and others as thick as the doors of treasure houses. There was one that looked like a giant's mouth, and another that had to be opened like a drawbridge. One that suggested a big ear, and one that was made of gingerbread. One that was shaped like an oven door, and one that had to be unbuttoned. The two doors leading out of a room always had something in common: the shape, the material, the size, the color. But there was always some essential difference between them. Bastian had passed many times from one hexagonal room to another. Every decision he made led to another decision that led to yet another decision. But after all these decisions, he was still in the Temple of 1,000 Doors. As he went on and on, he began to wonder why this should be. His wish had sufficed to lead him into the maze, but apparently it was not definite enough to enable him to find a way out. He had wished for company, but now he realized that by company he had meant no one in particular. This vague wish hadn't helped him at all. Thus far, his decisions had been based on mere whim and involved very little thought. In every case, he might just as well have taken the other door. At this rate, he would never find his way out. Just then he was in a room with a greenish light. Three of the six walls had variously shaped clouds painted on them. The door to the left was of white mother of pearl, the one on the right of ebony. And suddenly he knew whom he wished for. Atreyu. The mother of pearl door reminded Bastian of Falcor the luck dragon, whose scales glistened like mother of pearl. So he decided on that one. In the next room, one of the two doors was made of plaited grass, the other was an iron grating. Just then, Bastian was thinking of the grassy ocean where Atreyu was at home, so he picked the grass door. In the next room, he found two doors which differed only in that one was made of leather and the other of felt. Bastian chose the leather one. Then he was faced with two more doors, and again he had time to think. One was purple, the other olive green. Atreyu was a greenskin, and his cloak was made from the hide of a purple buffalo. A symbol such as Atreyu had had on his forehead and cheeks when Chiron came to him was painted in white on the olive green door. But the purple door had the same symbol on it, and Bastian didn't know that Atreyu's cloak had been ornamented with just such symbols. That door, he thought, must lead to someone else, not to Atreyu. He opened the olive green door, and then he was outside. To his surprise, he found himself not in the grassy ocean, but in a bright springtime forest. Sunbeams shone through the young foliage and played their games of light and shade on the mossy ground. The place smelled of earth and mushrooms, and the balmy air was filled with the twittering of birds. Bastian turned around and saw that he had just stepped out of a little forest chapel. For that moment, its door had been the way out of the Temple of a Thousand Doors. Bastian opened it again, but all he saw was the inside of a small chapel. The roof consisted only of a few rotted beams, and the walls were covered with moss. Bastian started walking. He had no idea where he was going, but he felt certain that sooner or later he would find Atreyu. The thought made him so happy that he whistled to the birds, who answered him and sang every merry tune that entered his head. A while later, he caught sight of a group of figures in a clearing. As he came closer, they proved to be four men in magnificent armor, and a beautiful lady who was sitting on the grass strumming a lute. Five richly caparisoned horses and a pack mule were standing in the background. A white cloth laid with all manner of viands and drink was spread out on the grass before the company. Before joining the group, Bastian hid the childlike empress's amulet under his shirt. He thought it best to see what these people were up to before allowing himself to be recognized. The men stood up and bowed low at his approach, evidently taking him for an oriental prince or something of the kind. The fair lady nodded, smiled at him, and went on strumming her lute. One of the men was taller than the rest and more magnificently clad. He had fair hair that hung down over his shoulders.
"I am Hero Hunrek," he announced, "and this lady is Princess Oglamar, daughter of the King of Luna. These men are my friends, Hukrion, Husbalt, and Hudon. And what may your name be, young friend?"
"I may not say my name, not yet," Bastian replied.
"A vow?"
Princess Oglamar asked on a note of mockery.
"So young, and you've already made a vow?"
"Have you come a long way?"
Hero Hunrek inquired.
"A very long way," Bastian replied.
"Are you a prince?"
asked the princess, with a gracious smile.
"That I may not reveal," said Bastian.
"Well, welcome, in any case, to our gathering," cried Hero Hunrek. "Will you honor us by partaking of our repast?"
Bastian accepted with thanks, sat down, and began to eat. From the conversation between the lady and the four knights, Bastian learned that a tournament was to be held in the large and magnificent silver city of Amarganth, which was not far distant.
From far and near, the boldest heroes, the most skillful hunters, the bravest warriors, and all manner of adventurers as well, had come to take part. Only the three bravest and best, who defeated all the others, were to have the honour of joining in a long and perilous expedition, the aim of which was to find a certain person, the so-called Saviour, who was known to be somewhere in one of the numerous regions of Fantastica. Thus far, no one knew his name. It appeared that at some time in the past, Fantastica had been struck by disaster, but that this Saviour had appeared on the scene and saved it in the nick of time by giving the childlike Empress the name of Moonchild, by which she was now known to everyone in Fantastica. Since then, he had been wandering about the country unknown, and the purpose of the expedition was to find him and keep him safe by serving him as a kind of bodyguard. Only the bravest and ablest men would be chosen for the mission, since it seemed more than likely that formidable adventures awaited them. The tournament at which the three were to be chosen had been organized by Quirkobad, the Silver Sage. The city of Amaganth was always ruled by its oldest man or woman, and Quirkobad was 107 years old. The winners, however, would not be selected by him, but by one Atreyu, a young greenskin, who was then visiting Sage Quirkobad. This Atreyu was to lead the expedition, for he alone was capable of recognizing the Saviour, since he had once seen him in his magic mirror. Bastian listened in silence. It wasn't easy for him, for he soon realized that this Saviour was his very own self. And when Atreyu's name came up, his heart laughed within him, and he found it very hard not to give himself away. But he was determined to keep his identity a secret for the present. Hero Hunrik, as it turned out, was not so much concerned with the expedition as with the heart of Princess Oglemar. Bastian had seen at a glance that he was head over heels in love with the young lady. For no apparent reason, he kept sighing and casting mournful glances at her. And she would pretend not to notice. As Bastian learned later on, she had vowed to marry no one but the greatest of all heroes, who proved himself able to defeat all others. She wouldn't be satisfied with less. But how could Hero Hunrik prove that he was the greatest? After all, he couldn't just go out and kill someone who had done him no harm. And as for wars, there hadn't been any for ages. He would gladly have fought monsters or demons. He would gladly have brought her a fresh dragon's tail for breakfast every morning. But far and wide, there were no monsters, demons or dragons to be found. So naturally, when the messenger from Quirkobad, the Silver Sage, had invited him to the tournament, he had accepted forthwith. But Princess Oglemar had insisted on coming along, for she wanted to see his performance with her own eyes. "Everybody knows," she said with a smile, "that heroes are not to be believed. They all tend to exaggerate their achievements."
"Exaggeration or not," said Hero Hunrik, "I can assure you that I'm a better man than this legendary Saviour."
"How can you know that?" Bastian asked.
"Well," said Hero Hunrik, "if the fellow was half as strong and brave as I am, he wouldn't need a bodyguard to take care of him. He sounds kind of pathetic to me."
"How can you say such a thing?" cried Oglemar with indignation. "Didn't he save Fantastica from destruction?"
"What of it?" said Hero Hunrik with a sneer. "That didn't take much of a hero."
Bastian decided to teach him a little lesson at the first opportunity. The three other knights had merely fallen in with the couple en route. Hukrion, who had a bristling black moustache, claimed to be the most powerful swordsman in all Fantastica. Huspalt, who had red hair and seemed frail in comparison with the others, claimed that no one was quicker and more nimble with a sword than he. And Hudorn was convinced that he had no equal for endurance in combat. His exterior seemed to support his contention, for he was tall and lean,
all bone and sinew. After the meal, they prepared to resume their journey. The crockery and provisions were packed into the saddlebags. Princess Oglemar mounted her white palfrey and trotted off without so much as a backward look at the others. Hero Hunrik leapt on his coal-black stallion and galloped after her. The three other knights offered Bastian a ride on their pack mule, which he accepted. Whereupon they started through the forest on their splendidly caparisoned steeds, while Bastian brought up the rear. Bastian's mount, an aged she-mule, dropped farther and farther behind. Bastian tried to goad her on, but instead of quickening her pace, the mule stopped still, twisted her neck to look back at him, and said, "Don't urge me on, sire. I've lagged behind on purpose."
"Why?"
Bastian asked.
"Because I know who you are."
"How can that be?"
"When a person is only half an ass like me, and not a complete one, she senses certain things. Even the horses had an inkling." "You needn't say anything, sire. I'd have been so glad to tell my children and grandchildren that I carried the Saviour on my back and was first to welcome him. Unfortunately, mules don't get children."
"What's your name?" Bastian asked.
"Yicca, sire." "Look here, Yicca. Don't spoil my fun. Could you keep what you know to yourself for the time being?" "Gladly, sire."
And the mule trotted off to catch up with the others. The group were waiting on a knoll at the edge of the forest, looking down with wonderment at the city of Amarganth, which lay gleaming in the sunlight before them. From the height where they stood, the travellers had a broad view over a large violet-blue lake, surrounded on all sides by similar wooded hills. In the middle of this lake lay the silver city of Amarganth. The houses were all supported by boats, and the large palaces by great barges. Every house and every ship was made of finely chiselled, delicately ornamented silver. The windows and doors of the palaces, great and small, the towers and balconies, were all of finely wrought silver filigree, unequalled in all Fantastica. The lake was studded with boats of all sizes, carrying visitors to the city from the mainland. Hero Hunrik and his companions hastened down to the shore, where a silver ferry with a magnificently curved prow was waiting. There was room in it for the whole company, horses, pack mule and all. On the way over, Bastian learned from the ferryman, whose clothes were woven of silver, that the violet-blue water of the lake was so salty and bitter that only silver, and a special kind of silver at that, could withstand its corrosive action for any length of time. The name of this lake was Moru, or Lake of Tears. In times long past, the people of Amarganth had ferried their city to the middle of the lake to protect it from invasion, since ships of wood or iron were quick to disintegrate in the acrid water. And at present there was yet another reason for leaving Amarganth in the middle of the lake, for the inhabitants had got into the habit of regrouping their houses and moving their streets and squares about when the fancy struck them. Suppose, for instance, that two families living at opposite ends of town made friends or intermarried. Why, then they would simply move their silver ships closer together and become neighbours. Bastian would gladly have heard more, but the ferry had reached the city, and he had to get out with his travelling companions. Their first concern was to find lodgings for themselves and their mounts, no easy matter, since Amarganth was literally overrun by visitors who had come from far and near for the tournament. At length, they found lodgings in an inn. After taking the she-mule to the stable, Bastian whispered in her ear, "Don't forget your promise, Yicca. I'll be seeing you soon again." Yicca nodded. Then Bastian told his travelling companions that he didn't wish to be a burden to them any longer, and would look about the town on his own. After thanking them for their kindness, he took his leave. Actually, he was intent on finding Atreyu. The large and small boats were connected by gangplanks, some so narrow that only one person could cross them at a time, others as wide as good-sized streets. There were also arched bridges with roofs over them, and in the canals between the palace ships, hundreds of small boats were moving back and forth. But wherever you went or stood, you felt a gentle rise and fall underfoot, just enough to remind you that the whole city was afloat. The visitors, who had literally flooded the city, were so varied and colourful that it would take a whole book to describe them. The Amarganthians were easy to recognise, for they all wore clothes of a silver fabric that was almost as fine as Bastian's mantle. Their hair, too, was silver. They were tall and well-built, and their eyes were as violet-blue as Moru, the Lake of Tears. Most of the visitors were not quite so attractive. There were muscle-bound giants with heads that seemed no larger than apples between their huge shoulders. There were sinister-looking night rowdies, bold, solitary individuals, whom, as one could see at a glance, it was best not to tangle with. There were flimflams with shifty eyes and nimble fingers, and berserkers with smoke coming out of their mouths and noses. There were topsy-turvies who spun like living tops, and wood goblins who trotted about on gnarled, crooked legs, carrying stout clubs over their shoulders. Once Bastian even saw a rock chewer with teeth like steel chisels jutting out of his mouth. The silver gangplank bent under his weight as he came stomping along. But before Bastian could ask him if by any chance he was Pion Krakzak, he had vanished in the crowd. At length, Bastian reached the center of the city, where the tournament was already in full swing. In a circular, open space that looked like a giant arena, hundreds of contestants were measuring their strength, showing their mettle. Around the edges, a crowd of onlookers egged the participants on, and the windows and balconies of the surrounding palace ships were packed with enthusiasts. Some had even managed to climb up on the filigree-ornamented roofs. At first, Bastian paid little attention to the tournament. He was looking for Atreyu, feeling sure that he must be somewhere in the crowd. Then he noticed that the onlookers kept turning expectantly toward one of the palaces, especially when a contestant had performed some particularly impressive feat. But before he could get a good look at the palace, Bastian had to thrust his way across one of the bridges and climb a sort of lamppost. Two silver chairs had been set up on a wide balcony. In one sat an aged man, whose silver beard and hair hung down to his waist. That must be Quirquabad, the silver sage. Beside him sat a boy of about Bastian's age. He was wearing long trousers made of soft leather, but he was bare from the waist up, and Bastian saw that his skin was olive green. The expression of his lean face was grave, almost stern. His long, blue-black hair was gathered together and held back by leather thongs. Over his shoulders he wore a purple cloak. He was looking calmly and yet somehow eagerly down at the arena. Nothing seemed to escape his dark eyes. Who could it be but Atreyu? At that moment, an enormous face appeared in the open balcony door behind Atreyu. It looked rather like a lion's, except that it had white mother-of-pearl scales instead of fur, and long white fangs gutted out of its mouth. The eyeballs sparkled ruby red, and when the head rose high above Atreyu, Bastian saw that it rested on a long, supple neck, from which hung a mane that looked like white fire. Of course it was Falkor, the luck dragon, and he seemed to be whispering something in Atreyu's ear, where Atreyu nodded. Bastian slid down the lamppost. He had seen enough. Now he could watch the tournament. Tournament was hardly the right word. The contests that were in progress added up to something more like a big circus. There was a wrestling match between two giants who twined their bodies into one huge knot that kept rolling this way and that. Individuals of like or divergent species vied with one another in swordsmanship or in skill at handling the club or the lance, but none had any serious intention of killing his adversary.
The rules called for fair fighting and the strictest self-control. Any contestant so misled by anger or ambition as to injure an opponent seriously would have been automatically disqualified. Many defeated combatants had left the arena when Bastian saw Hukrion the Strong, Husbalt the Swift, and Herdon the Enduring make their appearance. Hero Henrik and Princess Oglemar were not with them. By then there were scarcely more than 100 contestants left. Since these were a selection from among the best and strongest, Hukrion, Husbalt and Herdon had a much harder time of it than they may have expected. It took all afternoon for Hukrion to prove himself the strongest among the strong, Husbalt the swiftest among the swift, and Herdon the most enduring among the enduring. The onlookers applauded with a will, and all three bowed in the direction of the balcony, where Silver Sage Quirquebad and Atreyu were sitting. Atreyu was getting up to say something, when yet another contestant appeared. Henrik. An expectant silence fell, and Atreyu sat down. Since only three men were to accompany him on his expedition, there was one too many in the field. One would have to withdraw.
"Sires," said Henrik in a loud voice, "I would not suggest that your strength can have been impaired by the little display you have just made of your abilities. Under the circumstances, however, it would be unworthy of me to challenge you singly. Since I have thus far seen no adversary up to my standards, I have not participated in the contest. Consequently, I am still fresh. If any of you should feel too exhausted, he is free to stand aside. Otherwise, I am prepared to face all three of you at once. Any objections?"
"No," replied all three in unison. A furious battle followed. Hukrion's blows had lost none of their force, but Hero Henrik was stronger. Husbalt assailed him from all sides like streaks of lightning, but Henrik was quicker. Herdon tried to wear him down, but Hero Henrik had greater endurance. After barely 10 minutes, all three were disarmed, and all three bent their knees to Hero Henrik. He looked proudly about him, evidently hoping for an admiring glance from his lady, who must have been somewhere in the crowd. The cheers of the onlookers swept over the arena like a hurricane, and could no doubt be heard on the farthermost shore of Lake Muru. When the applause died down, Quirquebad the Silver Sage stood up and asked in a loud voice, "Does anyone wish to oppose Hero Henrik?" A hush fell on the crowd. Then a boy's voice was heard. "Yes, I do." All eyes turned toward Bastian. The crowd opened a path for him, and he strode into the arena. Cries of amazement and pity were heard. "How handsome he is! What a shame! This must be stopped!" "Who are you?" asked Silver Sage Quirquebad.
"I will reveal my name afterward," said Bastian.
He saw that Atreyu had narrowed his eyes and was studying him closely, but had not yet made up his mind.
"Young friend," said Hero Henrik, "we have eaten and drunk together. Why do you want me to put you to shame? I pray you, withdraw your challenge and go away."
"No," said Bastian, "I meant what I said." Hero Henrik hesitated a moment. Then he said,
"It would be wrong of me to measure myself in combat with you. Let us first see who can shoot an arrow higher."
"Very well," said Bastian. A stout bow and an arrow were brought for each of them. Henrik drew the bowstring and shot the arrow so high that the eye could not follow. At almost the same moment, Bastian pulled his bowstring and shot his arrow after it. It was some time before the arrows came down and fell to the ground between the two archers. Then it became evident that Bastian's red-feathered arrow had struck Hero Hunrek's blue-feathered arrow at its apogee with such force as to split it open and wedge itself into it. Hero Hunrek stared at the telescoped arrows. He had turned rather pale, but his cheeks had broken out in red spots.
"That can only be an accident," he muttered. "Let's see who does better with the foils." He asked for 2 foils and 2 decks of cards. Both were brought. He shuffled both decks of cards carefully. Then he threw 1 deck high into the air, drew his blade with the speed of lightning, and thrust. When all the other cards had fallen to the ground, it could be seen that he had struck the Ace of Hearts in the center of its one heart. And holding up his foil with the card spitted on it, he again looked about for his lady. Then Bastian tossed the other deck into the air, and his blade flashed. Not a single card fell to the ground. He had pierced all 52 cards of the deck exactly in the middle, and moreover in the right order, though Hero Hunrek had shuffled them ever so carefully. Hero Hunrek looked at the cards. He said nothing, but his lips trembled. "But you won't outdo me in strength," he stammered finally. A number of weights were still lying about from the previous contests. He seized the heaviest and slowly, straining every muscle, lifted it. But before he could set it down, Bastian had grabbed hold of him and lifted him along with the weight. Hero Henrik's face took on a look of such misery that some of the onlookers could not repress a smile. "Thus far," said Bastian, "you have chosen the nature of our contests. Will you allow me to suggest something?" Hero Henrik nodded in silence. "Nothing can daunt my courage." "In that case," said Bastian, "I propose a swimming race across the Lake of Tears." A breathless silence fell on the assemblage. Hero Henrik turned red and pale by turns. "That's no test of courage," he expostulated. "It's madness." "I'm ready," said Bastian. At that, Hero Henrik lost his self-control. "No," he shouted, stamping his foot. "You know as well as I do that the water of Moru dissolves everything. It would be certain death." "I'm not afraid," said Bastian calmly. "I've crossed the Desert of Colors. I've eaten and drunk the fire of the many-colored death and bathed in it. I'm not afraid of any water." "You're lying," roared Hero Henrik, purple with rage. "No one in all Fantastica can survive the many-colored death. Any child knows that." "Hero Henrik," said Bastian slowly, "instead of calling me a liar, why not admit that you're just plain scared?" That was too much for Hero Henrik. Beside himself with rage, he drew his big sword from its sheath and flung himself on Bastian. Bastian stepped back. He was about to say a word of warning, but Hero Henrik didn't leave him time. He struck out in earnest, and in that same moment, the sword Sikander leapt from its rusty sheath into Bastian's hand and began to dance. What happened next was so amazing that not one of the onlookers would forget it as long as he lived. Luckily, Bastian couldn't let go of the hilt and was obliged to follow all Sikander's lightning-like movements. First, it sliced Hero Hunrek's lovely armor into little pieces. They flew in all directions, but his skin was not even scratched. Hero Henrik swung his sword like a madman in a desperate effort to defend himself, but he was blinded by Sikander's whirling light, and none of his blows struck home. At length, he was stripped to his underclothes, but he still went on fighting. And then Sikander cut his weapon into little bits so quickly that what had been a whole sword only a moment before fell tinkling to the ground like a pile of coins. Hero Henrik stared aghast at the useless hilt, dropped it, and hung his head. Sikander left Bastian's hand and flew back into its rusty sheath. A cry of admiration rose from 1,000 throats. The onlookers stormed the arena, seized Bastian, lifted him onto their shoulders, and carried him around in triumph. From his lofty perch, Bastian looked for Hero Henrik. He felt sorry for the poor fellow, and wanted to give him a kind word. He hadn't intended to make such a fool out of him.
but Hero Hunrek was nowhere to be seen. Then silence fell. The crowd moved aside. There stood Atreyu, smiling up at Bastian. Bastian smiled back. His bearers let him down from their shoulders. For a long while, the two boys looked at each other in silence. Then Atreyu spoke.
If I still needed someone to accompany me on the search for the savior of Fantastica, I would content myself with just this one, for he is worth more than 100 others. But I need no companion, because there will be no expedition. A murmur of surprise and disappointment was heard. The savior of Fantastica has no need of our protection, Atreyu went on, raising his voice, for he can defend himself better than all of us together could defend him. And we have no need to look for him, because he has already found us. I didn't recognize him at first, but when I saw him in the magic mirror gate of the Southern Oracle, he was different from now, entirely different. But I didn't forget the look in his eyes. It's the same look that I see now. I couldn't be mistaken. Bastian shook his head and said with a smile, You're not mistaken, Atreyu. It was you who brought me to the Childlike Empress to give her a new name. And for that, I thank you. An awed whisper passed over the crowd like a gust of wind. You promised, Atreyu replied, to tell me your name, which is known to no one in Fantastica except the golden-eyed Commander of Wishes. Will you tell us now? My name is Bastian Balthazar Books. At that, the onlookers could contain themselves no longer. Their rejoicing exploded in 1,000 cheers. Many of them started dancing. Bridges and gangplanks, the whole square for that matter, began to sway. Laughing, Atreyu held out his hand to Bastian. Bastian took it. And so, hand in hand, they went to the palace. Silver Sage Quirquabad and Falcor the Luck Dragon were waiting on the palace steps. That night, the city of Amarganth staged the finest celebration in all its history. All who had legs, long or short, straight or crooked, danced, and all who had voices, sweet or sour, high or low, sang and laughed. When night fell, the Amarganthians lit thousands of coloured lamps on their silver ships and palaces, and at midnight there were fireworks such as had never been seen in Fantastica. Bastian stood on the balcony with Atreyu. To the left and right of them stood Falcor and Silver Sage Quirquabad, watching as sheaves of many-coloured light and the Silver City's thousands of lamps were reflected in the dark waters of Moru, the Lake of Tears. 17. A Dragon for Hero Hunrek. Quirquabad, the Silver Sage, had slumped down in his chair, asleep. For already the hour was late. Consequently, he missed an experience more beautiful and more extraordinary than any he had known in the 107 years of his life. And so did many others in Amarganth, citizens as well as visitors, who, exhausted by the festivities, had gone to bed. Only a few were still awake, and those few were uniquely privileged. Falcor, the White Luck Dragon, was singing. High in the night sky, he flew in circles over the Lake of Tears, and let his bell-like voice ring out in a song without words, a simple, grandiose song of pure joy. The hearts of all those who heard it opened wide. And so it was with Bastian and Atreyu, who were sitting side by side on the broad balcony of Quirquabad's palace. Neither had ever heard the song of a luck dragon before. Hand in hand, they listened in silent delight. Each knew that the other shared his feeling, a feeling of joy at having found a friend.
and they took care not to spoil it with idle words. The great hour passed. Falkor's song grew faint and gradually died away. When all was still, Quirquabad woke up and excused himself. "I'm afraid," he said, "that old men like me need their sleep. I'm sure you youngsters will forgive me. I must really be off to bed." They wished him a good night, and Quirquabad left them. Again the two friends sat for a long while in silence, looking up at the night sky, where the luck dragon was still flying in great, slow circles. From time to time he passed across the full moon like a drifting cloud. "Doesn't Falkor ever sleep?" Bastian asked finally. "He's asleep now," Atreya replied.
"In the air?"
"Oh, yes. He doesn't like to stay in houses, even when they're as big as Quirquabad's palace. He feels cramped. He's just too big, and he's afraid of knocking things over. So he usually sleeps way up in the air. Do you think he'd let me ride him sometime?" "Of course he would," said Atreo, "though it's not easy. You've got to get used to it."
"I've already ridden Grogramon," said Bastian.
Atreo nodded and looked at him with admiration. "So you said during your contest with Hero Hunrek. How did you tame the many-colored death?"
"I have Orin," said Bastian.
"Oh," said Atreo. He seemed surprised, but he said nothing more. Bastian took the childlike empress's emblem from under his shirt and showed it to Atreo. Atreo looked at it for a while. Then he muttered, "So now you are wearing the gem." Thinking he detected a note of displeasure, Bastian hastened to ask, "Would you like to have it back?" He started undoing the chain.
"No."
Atreo's voice sounded almost harsh, and Bastian wondered what was wrong. Atreo smiled apologetically and repeated gently, "No, Bastian. I haven't worn it in a long while."
"As you like," said Bastian.
Then he turned the amulet over.
"Look," he said, "have you seen the inscription?"
"Yes," said Atreo, "I've seen it, but I don't know what it says."
"How come?"
"Greenskins can read tracks in the forest, but not letters." This time it was Bastian who said,
"Oh."
"What does it say?" Atreo asked. "Do what you wish," Bastian read. Atreo stared at the amulet.
"So that's what it says."
His face revealed nothing, and Bastian couldn't guess what he was thinking. "If you had known," he asked, "would it have changed anything for you?"
"No," said Atreo. "I did what I wanted to do."
"That's true," said Bastian, and nodded. Again they were both silent for a time.
"There's something I have to ask you," said Bastian finally. "You said I looked different from when you saw me in the magic mirror gate."
"Yes,"